Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We are living in a time in which minority groups are victims of an uptick in incidents of bias and hate crimes. It's happening all over the country. How the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, is confronting the problem a little bit later in this broadcast. But first, a look at a problem that is off the radar of most of us, although it affects millions of Americans. It's one of the consequences of grinding poverty. People who are poor are usually renters, and when they can't pay the rent, they are evicted, tossed out onto the street. It's a well-known process here in St. Louis. Our first guest is an educator-author who has studied the issue. Harvard University's Dr. Matthew Desmond is the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He'll be keynoting the St. Louis Equal Housing and Opportunity Council's annual conference here later this week. He joins us by phone. In studio is Kalila Jackson, the Equal Housing Opportunity and Education Council staff attorney. She represents clients with fair housing complaints in our region. Thank you both so much for being with us. Matt, nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Kalila, good to have you in studio with us. Matt, let me start with you. I was surprised in getting ready for this program to see that this is an issue that affects millions of Americans. That's a stunning number.
That sounds right. I mean, we need a lot more data on this issue, but if you look at the numbers city by city, they're just shocking. You know, there's 40 evictions a day that happen in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 60 Marshall evictions happen every day in New York City. The last time we rolled out the American Housing Survey, we asked renters, do you think you'll be evicted soon? And 2.8 million renting homes, families in those homes said yes to that question. So it looks like we've moved from a place where eviction used to be pretty rare in our cities and drew crowds to a place where we're evicting people not in the tens or even hundreds of thousands, but likely in the millions.
What is the process of eviction? How does it work? How much warning do people have? And who are the people who are evicted?
It varies from city to city. Some families have 5 days process. Some have 30. Landlords can go through a legal formal process, which I think, depending on the city, takes about a month or 2 months to execute from notifying the family to a sheriff physically removing your belongings. Let me just tell you how it happens in Milwaukee, which is the city that I know best on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you fall behind, and that's the reason why most families are brought to eviction court, they fall behind in rent. They're given an eviction notice. It's called a 5-day notice. It basically says leave or pay the balance. If families can't do either, they're summoned to court, and they have about 2 weeks to appear, and they go to eviction court. And I think what's important to recognize is, you know, if you get arrested for a crime in America, you have a right to an attorney, but you have no such right in civil court. So most families who show up to housing court, they don't have a right to an attorney. They don't have access to an attorney. So a lot of families just don't show up. You know, I have a PhD. If I had to face off with an attorney, I don't know if I'd show up. And so if they go to eviction court, they face off with a lawyer or their landlord, and usually it's really up to the landlord's discretion whether they stay or go. And if they do receive an eviction judgment, then they have 10 days to get out. And if they don't, then the judge can file a writ of restitution and remove the family by force, by sheriff.
Are there generally, in various cities, you can address Milwaukee, services available either to come up with the rent money or once they are evicted to have someplace to go?
Sure. I mean, so the issue usually isn't in the design of services, but just the dosage of those services. And I think that many Americans still believe that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits from some other kind of help when it comes to meeting basic housing needs. But the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 families who qualify for any kind of housing help receive it. So when we think of a typical poor family today, we shouldn't think of them living in public housing towers like Puget Igo or other things like that. We should think of them living in the private rental market, receiving no government help, and giving most of their money to their landlord and their utility company. There are services for folks that fall behind in rent and services that help folks avoid homelessness or at least street homelessness after their eviction. The plain brute fact of the matter, though, is those services don't stand up to the need.
Let's turn to Kalila now and get some sense of what's going on here in the city of St. Louis. I noted you were nodding in affirmation to just about every... Is he talking about St. Louis?
Really, he could be talking about any major metropolitan city in this country. And when I read Matthew's book, I was struck by the similarities of the issues that we see right here on the ground in St. Louis. One of the things, one of the reasons why EHOC exists is to provide attorney legal representation, free legal representation, in order to kind of fill the gap, because so many people would face these daunting obstacles without our representation.
So we're a little bit ahead of Milwaukee in that regard.
Well, I'm sure there may be other social services, legal services, for example, I'm sure operates in that area. But again, the need overtaxes the resources that are available to people.
Do you have any sense of the number of evictions that take place in St. Louis on a daily, weekly, monthly basis?
Well, we did one of my colleagues, Zachary Schmoke, did a brief study, nowhere near the level that Matthew studied. But in 2012, we looking strictly at the city of St. Louis, and there were 6,369 cases filed for eviction in 2012 alone.
Is it fair to assume that all of those people were evicted?
All but two of those people were evicted.
6,000.
6,369 cases. There were two that resulted in judgments in favor of the renter.
Matt, are you trying to say something?
No, just reacting to the stark numbers. I mean, those are numbers that are equivalent to Milwaukee's numbers. You know, the fact that all but two of the families were evicted seems quite high. Yeah.
Khalilah, where do these 6,000 plus people go? What's there for them?
Not much, Don. We see a lot of these people, they are forced back into the same type of housing conditions that Matthew's book explored. So you have people that are living in substandard housing, paying more for rent than you might think, and taking everything that they have to live in buildings that are sometimes falling down around them. And it ends up being a revolving door where they're bouncing from place to place, usually in the private market, just as Matthew described.
I would assume there's a lot of doubling up, going with friends, relatives, or trying to exist that way.
Some. Yeah. But a lot of people, maybe for a while, they may live with a relative, but that tires. And then we have people who, again, they're back into that more what I call the secondary rental market that exists almost in the shadows. And they are renting from landlords who may not follow the housing codes, the maintenance codes, the way that they should be.
Literally going from bad to worse.
Literally going oftentimes from bad to worse.
Typical kinds of scenarios, I guess, Matt, that you found in Milwaukee during your research.
One thing that I was really struck by was the fact that, you know, eviction isn't just a condition of poverty, it's a cause of it. Mm. It does make people's lives worse. You know, eviction comes with a mark or a blemish if it's processed in the court system, and a lot of landlords will turn you away. And so that's why we found evidence that evicted families are pushed into worse housing and into worse neighborhoods after their eviction. And, you know, that has really bad effects on kids' health and well-being. A lot of public housing authorities also turn families away if they have an eviction record. So we are systematically excluding from public housing families that need it most. We have a study that shows that moms who get evicted experience high rates of depression 2 years later. We know that suicides attributed to eviction doubled between 2005 and 2010 around the country, years where housing costs were soaring. And I think, you know, you add all that up, you know, you are left with this conclusion that eviction isn't just something that happens to low-income families or families that run on hard times, but it's something that actually increases their disadvantage. And I think that it should be – go ahead.
No, I don't. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah, it should just be at the top of our domestic agenda. It should be an item, especially the lack of affordable housing in our cities, that policymakers care about deeply.
Yeah, you write, this means it is impossible to address poverty in America without fixing housing. That's how big a deal this is.
Absolutely.
I think it is. I mean, we've reached a point in America where the majority of poor renting families are spending at least half of their income on housing costs, and one in four of those families are spending over 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. And, you know, whatever our issue is, whatever keeps us up at night, you know, if it's crime reduction, you know, we know that neighborhoods with more evictions actually have more violent crime the following year, you know, and I think we can understand why. It kind of rips apart the social fabric of a community. If we care about educational inequality or driving down health problems in our cities or stabilizing families and neighborhoods, I think we have to care about finding a way to provide more safe, affordable, decent homes.
Two things that were alluded to in the last minute or two. One is women. My understanding is that many of the people who are evicted are women living alone or with children, and, of course, children themselves.
That. Well, Ms. Jackson must see this every day in her work, but, you know, if you do walk into an urban housing court, you see a lot of kids running around. You know, until recently, the housing court in the South Bronx in New York City had a daycare inside of it because there were so many kids coming through its doors. And African-American women and moms in particular are evicted at incredibly high rates. You know, among Milwaukee renters, one in five African-American women reports being evicted sometime in her life, compared to one in 15 white women. That's a deeply troubling statistic. I think that should make us pause, because it suggests that eviction is almost the feminine equivalent to incarceration. You know, it suggests that, you know, that many of our poor young black men are being locked up, but many of our poor African American women are being locked out, and they are disproportionately bearing the brunt of the eviction crisis. Now, you mentioned kids. And I thought kids would be a mitigating factor in evictions, and they're not. They're actually an aggravating factor. So we have a statistical study that shows that, you know, if you want to know why you get evicted but not you, even though you owe your landlord the exact same amount, but what really matters is kids. The chances of you receiving an eviction judgment in court triple, all else equal, if you have kids living with you. And I think what you're seeing there is landlord discretion. Because kids can be kind of, you know, tough on properties.
Well, one of the things, and we see those exact disparities in our everyday practice. And if we come across landlords that we think are targeting families with children for higher eviction rates, or particularly for eviction, our agency will step in and sue those landlords, to be mm-hmm. frank, mm-hmm. Because that is illegal. That is illegal under the Fair Housing Act. Whether you're talking on the state level, it's as illegal in Missouri as it is in Milwaukee, as it is in California. Right. That's federal law.
We have to take a break. Let's do that now. We're talking with Matthew Desmond, the author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and Khalila Jackson, who was with the Equal Housing and Opportunity Council here in St. Louis. The subject, obviously, is evictions. We'll continue that discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and Khalila Jackson, who was with the Equal Housing and Opportunity Council. Matt, let me come back to you. Is the profile of the people who are being evicted changing at all? I'm thinking of younger people who may be having trouble paying rent. Times are difficult. A lot of them are living at home, but when they go out, sometimes it's difficult to sustain it. Is the profile changing?
We don't know. At least we don't know in the data world. Ms. Jackson might know just by being on the front lines every day. But we do know that eviction affects the young and the old and the sick and the able-bodied. We do know it has a disproportionate effect on families with children and disproportionate effect on low-income renters, particularly those who are African-American and Latino. That's where the data get us. We don't know if that profile has changed. I think the basic thing to understand about eviction is that there are so many people out there that are paying most of their income on rent and utilities. And so what that means is they're confronted with these incredibly difficult decisions. You know, should I pay the rent or buy my kids' school clothes? Should I pay the rent or pay for this medical bill? And you know, these are the kind of conditions that lead to our high rates of eviction. It's just this high rate of rent burden among families living in cities today.
Khalilah, do you see any change in the profile?
Not so much in terms of the age of the renters, but one thing just to piggyback on some of the points that Matthew made. In addition, we see these burdens also fall on people who are receiving federal disability benefits. Because, again, it's this affordable housing crisis that is a nationwide issue.
Right. Hey, just a quick question to you, Khalilah. On the ballot tomorrow is Proposition NS, which stands for Stabilizing Neighborhoods. Is this likely to help this eviction situation at all?
You know, I apologize. I can't speak to that particular. I'm not familiar enough.
They're going to make vacant houses stabilized so that they can be purchased at a very low price and people can obviously utilize them.
Yes. And so, well, it's yet to be seen how the program is actually going to shake out in terms of the specifics. But I actually was encouraged to see that the city is taking some steps, because what we need to do now, the study, the data that Matthew has brought to light has started this conversation, but now we need to start looking at what are the next steps and what are we going to do to actually start removing the barriers that we're seeing. And that's the type of proactive step on the part of the city that we are encouraged by, but we need to see more and in some differing areas.
Matt, what's your take on what can be done? We know what should be done, but what can be done, do you think, realistically?
Well, the good news is the programs that we have now are working. You know, so when families finally receive a housing voucher, for example, after years and years and years on the waiting list, when they finally receive this ticket that allows them to pay only 30% of their income on housing instead of 60 or 70, they do one really consistent thing with that feed of income. They take it to the grocery store and they buy more food. You know, their kids become stronger. They move less. They move into better neighborhoods. They are able to invest in job programs. They get them plugged into the labor market better. They work for the lucky minority of families that receive them. And so, you know, again, it's not a question about smarting this problem. It's kind of like, how can we hate it more? Mm. There's good news that, you know, cities all across the country are figuring out ways to combat this problem in their own way. You know, Seattle, for example, just passed a housing levy, and they'll raise almost $300 million over the next 7 years, you know, that goes directly to affordable housing. New York City just passed the nation's first ever right to counsel in housing court, so that everyone that steps into eviction court in that city will have a lawyer by their side. So I think cities are figuring out ways to address this issue in a lot of different ways, but I think cities alone will not be able to address it at scale. We need significant federal investment in the problem, too.
Well, that may be a very key element here. Would you look for help from the current administration, for instance? Do you see any signs indicating that there is some simpatico here?
I think housing stability is not a partisan issue. It is a bipartisan issue, and it has been for years. You know, if we care about spending and being fiscally responsible, look, we could spend smart or we can spend stupid. And if we don't want to spend for more stable housing, we could spend on more health problems and more educational turnover. If we want to care about community and family stability, I think we need to care about stable, affordable housing. If we want to care about jobs and getting people to work, I think we need to provide them a place where they can have a foothold in their community and not have to worry about a roof over their head. So I don't think this is a partisan issue. Now, with that said, you know, the early glimpses that we've seen of the Trump budget suggest a 14% reduction in the budget of HUD, of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's going to cause a lot of pain if that goes through. That's going to mean more homelessness. That's going to mean more instability within low-income communities. And I think that, you know, if that passes, that should trouble us. It's not going to be innocent of consequences. It's going to have huge ramifications on low-income communities.
Kalila?
One of the things that the City of St. Louis has done well is last year the City of St. Louis actually expanded protection to housing choice voucher recipients, which we used to call Section 8, so that they cannot be discriminated against. And so Matthew is right. Families, when they get their vouchers, naturally they want to expand their opportunities for themselves, for their families, for their kids. One of the barriers to that expansion is that there are no protections for families who have Section 8 vouchers. Landlords routinely refuse to accept those vouchers in areas throughout the city and the county. And so what it ends up is that our Section 8 vouchers in our area tend to be in concentrated areas of poverty. So while I absolutely agree that there are strides that have been made and there are good things that have been done, we have to move some of the structural barriers that exist, particularly, and I'm speaking in our area. Mm-hmm. And chief among those is we need to have some explicit protections for families that have vouchers so that they cannot be discriminated against. And in addition, I would encourage cities to tie in robust code enforcement so that families are not forced into substandard housing. And if they are, that there are adequate legal protections for families that raise those issues so they cannot then be evicted retaliatorily from a landlord. And right now we don't have those protections.
And this is something that can be actually accomplished on the local level.
Yes.
You don't have to go to the state nor to the federal government.
You don't. These are things that can be done on the local government so we can go to our state. Like we can go to the county council, we can go to the alderman. And the City of St. Louis in particular has done that. I'd like to see the other municipal governments do the same and follow suit.
Matt, makes sense to you?
I think that if we want housing vouchers to work to their full capacity, we are going to have to think really hard about source of income discrimination, what Ms. Jackson was talking about. I also think that we need to figure out if we're gonna take this problem on at scale, we have to figure out a way to get landlords around the table. We have to figure out, okay, why are you turning away vouchers? What's going on? You know, why won't you take this benefit? And I think that we need to have an open and frank conversation with property owners. You know, we've decided to house most of our low-income families in the private market, so those owners have to be a big part of the solution.
So a lot of work to be done, needless to say.
Yes, but the good news is, like, we've taken on enormous problems like this and won, right? I mean, for me, it's important to recognize that a few generations ago, there were slums in our cities, you know, and we had kids dying of tuberculosis, and we had outhouses in the middle of East St. Louis, and we took on a battle with the slum, and we won, you know, and, you know, the book is clear-eyed about the fact that we have a long way to go, but I don't think anyone would say, you know, we haven't made enormous progress in terms of the quality of housing that we're living in today, just given in a few generations ago. And I always kind of try to remind my students of this, you know, because sometimes they hear this idea that, you know, there's nothing we can do about these issues. You know, we fought poverty and poverty won. That's just empirically false.
I'm going to have to end this in a moment, but Kalila, I can't help but noticing you rolled your eyes when he was talking about slums being gone.
Well, not so much role. It's more or less that there are people who are still living in slum, many people in our community who are living in slum-like conditions. And we haven't done enough, and there is still much work to be done.
Well, obviously, I'm stunned by some of the information that you two have given us today. It's just, as I said to you before we went on the air, it's hard to believe that this is the 21st century in the United States of America when there are conditions like this that prevail in city after city after city.
I'm also hopeful and echo Matthew's sentiment that the progress that we've made is remarkable in the last 100 years. It's just we have more to be done.
Matt, in a few seconds, a final thought.
I couldn't agree more with that. And I just think that, you know, without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. Just, you know, and it's such an honor to be on the show with Ms. Jackson. And I just applaud her work and her vision.
Well, I want to thank you both, Kalila Jackson of Equal Housing Opportunity and Education Council, and Professor Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He's in town for the EHOC's annual conference later this week. We'll have details on our website. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.